Okay, we're live. Tony, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jake. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining. And I think this is the first family member that I've had on the pod, which is great. So I launched in January. And for context of those listening, Tony is my wife's uncle. So my wife's mum's brother, which is epic. And I can't wait to have you on and learn more about yourself, Tony. So where I want to start today is I was doing some research and having a look at your website, and we'll link it in the show notes so people can find what you're up to. But you touched on a story that I've never had the chance to ask you about. And you mentioned being around 30 years of age and being a single dad with three kids, and you were in a Centrelink, and you're like, fuck, what am I going to do? And forgive me if it's a difficult time, but I would love to start there. Because from what your website explained, that was really when your investment journey started as well. So what the hell was going on? And take me back to that day.
Yeah, look, absolutely, Jake. I came out of a big family. There was eight kids in our family, real working class background. You know, mum and dad were really hard workers. And, you know, we were taught that hard work ethic. And as what happens with most people in life, generally speaking, is that whatever mum and dad learned, generally they'll pass it down to you. And if you didn't learn much about money or finances or whatnot, then you're probably going to run the same sort of storyline as, you know, your parents and your peers. So I'd left school at 15 and been out working my way around through life and on the building sites. And then in 1994, I was married and I had three kids. I bought a franchise, Jake, thinking, you know what, I want to get out of the building industry. You know, I'm not going to do this all my life. And I bought this franchise. And it was a really good lesson because my gut instinct at the time said, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, right? But a bit of pressure come on from the franchisors who were selling it, and one thing led to another, and I put all my money into it, right? And the business went really, really well, right? I had people working on Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. We were doing home deliveries of fish and chips, chicken, seafood platters. I was doing prawns, oysters, the whole shebang. But unbeknownst to us, the actual franchise owners had run up debts with all the food suppliers, you know, all the big national food suppliers like PFD, Lewis, Conway's, all the big ones.
Wow.
The debts were around about $800,000 in 1994, which was massive. They filled out dodgy credit applications in all our names of all the franchise shop owners, like myself.
Oh, wow.
So overnight, Jake, here's what happened is that we were all put out of business. We couldn't get any supplies from any of the suppliers. The CIB and the fraud squad got involved chasing these people because they've disappeared and shut up shop and they've gone. And here I was. It gets better. Gets better. So long story short, basically what happened was, and look, being a bit young and a bit naive, around 30 or 33 or whatever I was back then, I could have worked my way around it, but I didn't understand much. I had never been in business before. I was a knockabout construction worker. And so basically we shut the shop down. I owned all the equipment in the shop, the fryers, the cookers, the fridges, the freezers, all that sort of stuff. So I gave them to a bloke called Bob who was going to sell them for me. Well, I'd never seen Bob again. He disappeared. So I didn't get any money back off that. And over a period of about 2 or 3 months, my wife decided to leave, and my kids were 8, 7, and 3 at the time. So I got custody of the kids. We got robbed on Christmas Day. We went to a family Christmas in Melbourne, come home, and the house had been burgled. This all happened in about 3 or 4 months, right? So you think, holy, holy moly, what am I going to do, right? And I could have, I was really at a point in life where I was at a crossroad. I thought, you know what? I can go down the path of self-destruction and anger and really firing up and heading down that journey, which I thought about. And then, you know, one of the cops said to me, hey, listen, Tony, I know you've lost this and you've lost that. He said, look, you know, at the end of the day, you're just going to have to start again. And that's basically what I did. So in 1994, I was left with three kids, 8, 7, and 3. I had $10 to my name and owned nothing. Was completely broke. I'd lost every cent I had. So I just went back to work on building sites then, Jake, because that's what I knew and that's where I could earn some money and that's where I could just start again. And fast forward, say, 3 or 4 years, I did a Tony Robbins seminar, you know, Unleash the Power Within. I met a lot of people done it, did the fire walk, and I thought, oh, personal development. How long's this stuff been around? Why didn't someone teach me this when I was at school or leaving school, right?
Yeah.
And that journey then moved me along the path of where I am today, and that was really the catalyst back then. So as hard as it was at the time, it was actually probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. You know?
And, wow. And I definitely resonate in terms of the idea that our darkest times are sometimes the springboard for our best times. And when you're in those moments, you don't realize, obviously, because you're like, this is a disaster. How do I get out of this? And to dwell on that for a moment, you mentioned, you know, the option was there to self-destruct. What was it, if you can remember, that helped you not choose that option? Was like there a moment or a conversation? Maybe it was the Tony Robbins experience, but decision-making always fascinates me. And there must have been something that happened that made you go, actually, that's not right.
Yeah, the trigger was pretty simple. There was a policeman who was talking to me this particular day about what it all had happened. And he said, hey, look, Tony, there's two ways you can go. You can go down the path of a loser. You can go down the path of self-destruction. He said, where's that going to get you and your kids? Or you take what you've done, you learn from it, and you move ahead. And I just basically thought about my three kids. I thought, you know what? I've got to find a way. So I just chose to go back to work and get a job back on building sites to just start making some money again. And I realised that I'd spoken to Galbelly, one of the best lawyers in Victoria at the time, and he was really good. He said, look, Tony, you can pay me another $10,000. I'll chase these people, but they've got a $2 shelf company. You're not going to get anything back. And again, he was another one who said, you know what, it's not good what's happened. However, just cut your losses, move on, and you just have to start again. So the reality was the reality, Jake. I just had no choice but to head down that path and rebuild.
And so that Tony Robbins seminar that you went to, so this was maybe 3 or 4 years after making the decision to go back into construction work, and you stumbled across it, or a friend told you about it? Like, how did you end up there?
Well, it was interesting because I was right into sport as a kid, and all I wanted to do was play sport and play AFL league footy. And I came across a guy called Terry McClendon who was doing NLP, and I did a Sports Mind sports performance NLP course with Terry McClendon and a guy called Jeffrey Hodges. And from there, I wanted to go out and teach sports people how to run their mind and mindsets to be, you know, good, high-quality elite athletes, right? So then that led me to a book that one of the people in the class said, oh, you should check this Tony Robbins guy out and read this book. And I think it was called The Power Within. And so I read the book, and then next, of course, I've come across his seminar. So I've been on a journey of personal development and stuff like that ever since. And I still do stuff today that, you know, improve your mindset and get you thinking better and, you know, plan and map out your life.
And it's crazy, isn't it, that those, well, like everything, you learn with experience. And so school in some ways is just a complete waste of time. And in particular, when you come across things such as what you're referencing, it's like, how on earth was this information not given to me before? But that's when I almost get a bit spiritual about things, in terms of information reveals itself at important times and you just weren't ready to receive it perhaps. And that's what the journey is all about. So we're in the 90s still. Today we're 2025. We've got a whole nother 20 odd years to get through. So to stick to maybe the investing track, when was the first time you're like, oh, okay, I've got some capital saved up now. I'm not going to go into a franchise where I, you know, can't see what the franchisor is actually doing. What was the process that you went through?
I think the first goal was to try to build a bit of security, right? And as you know, in Australia, everybody wants to own their own house, which, you know, now I know nowadays is probably not the best move you can make either. But the first challenge was get a deposit and buy a house, right? So I've got some stability. So that was the first goal. Which I did. And then over that period, and the personal journey came along, you know, I read a book called The Psychology of Winning by Dennis Waitley. And it was about positive self-motivation, self-awareness, goal setting, all this type of stuff. And again, I'm looking at going, why didn't someone teach me this? So I started going into high schools in Geelong and the western suburbs of Melbourne, teaching personal development stuff to year 10, year 11 kids, right? Because I'm a big believer that when you learn, you apply, you get results, then go teach, right? And maybe the same with you, Jake, with your business. You had to learn, you had to apply, you had to understand it, and then you can go and teach it, right? So I did a similar thing. But I also incorporated that into my footy coaching, into my personal life. I did a fair bit of one-on-one stuff with elite athletes and things like that. So that was all part of that mindset journey. So getting the security, you know, of your first home or my home again was number one objective. But then I read a book called Real Estate Riches by a guy called Dolph DeRoos. Dolph has never had a job. He went to university and he stumbled across a property deal. He made a lot of money out of one property deal and gave uni away. He's been a property investor ever since. But so that book taught me a lot. So I've really just been on this learning discovery journey. And at the time, I think it was 2000 when I bought that property. By 2002-2003, I bought my first investment property. Then I bought another one and subdivided it. But then at that point in time, I didn't know about markets. I didn't know about property cycles. I didn't know I'm in a growth spurt. So a lot of those properties that I bought back then were going up in value because we had a spurt between 2003 and 2006, right? But I'm none the wiser. This is just a fluke, right, that I bought and did what I did at the right time. And then the more I started to learn, then I started to get smarter people around me. You know, I met a smart tax accountant. I met a smart finance broker. Hey, Tony, it's good what you've done, but hey, it's pretty stupid. You should have did it like this, you know, and setting up structures and minimizing tax and all this sort of stuff, Jake, just evolved by getting into the game and going out and doing it. And the thing that I loved the most was that I'm really good at building relationships, and I had a strategy about what to buy, how to buy. You know, I researched the market for 3 months. So by the time I bought, I knew exactly what the property was worth or what I should pay for it. And I negotiated deals where I bought properties, you know, 15, 20, 30% undervalued. Right. Nice. But I didn't know about creating equity. I didn't know how equity worked. I didn't know how you pull loans. I just learned the first 5 or so years just being in the street, going out and doing it, taking a few risks.
And I love that. It's so key. Like, just so what's the phrase that I love? Action leads to clarity. Yes. So it's only through the doing that you figure out what it is you want to do. And you fuck up. Like, the point. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like you've got to take some risk, because if you don't, then you'll never learn what the wrong thing to do is, which is just as important as what the right thing is. So I'd love to piece these deals apart a bit more then, Tony. So you were in Geelong specifically buying these houses from 2003 to 2006.
Yeah.
Okay, and for those of you listening that aren't aware, like, Geelong's just south of Melbourne. So, and they were residential homes, or it was commercial property?
Residential.
Yeah, okay. And so what was the investment lens that you had at the time? And talk us through, you've mentioned a bunch of stuff that we can spend some time on: tax, financing, structuring, like, give some examples as to, like, when you realized you'd made a mistake and how you then iterated on from that.
Yeah, look, the home that I bought had gone up in value, right? And I met a finance broker who says, oh, you could pull some money out of that house of yours and use it to go and buy another property. And I've been reading these books by Dolph DeRoos, so I had a bit of a general understanding of how it worked, but I never actually did it. So he did the first one for me. But again, I found a real estate agent in Geelong who really didn't care about the vendors, and he basically told me when there was distressed properties that these people were selling, they needed to get out. So it was a really funny story. The first property that I bought as an investment, it turns out that some Asian people had lived in the house and owned the house, but they built a room onto this home which they hadn't had council approval for, right? So I rang up the local council, the Geelong council. Said, look, I'm looking at buying this property here, but there's a room on the back, but I can't see it on the contract. And they said, oh, yeah, we know all about it. We've told them they've got to demolish it and pull it up, because they went and built it without any planning permits, right? But that's a nice little negotiating tool that I can use.
Nice.
So what I did, I whacked up this list of what I thought it was going to cost to do the demo, because I was in construction at the time. And I went back to the agent and said, hey, listen, you got that property there. What are their terms? What are they looking for? Why are they selling? Why do they want to get out, right? I want to know what's the need of the seller. Because if I can understand their situation or their position, then I can frame a deal that's probably going to accommodate them but also accommodate me. So I worked out what they wanted. And I said, look, I'll give you I think they asked 140, 145 for it at the time. I put in an offer for 127, but I said I want a 60-day settlement. I want access after 30 days because it's going to cost me nearly $25,000 to actually do this demo job. So he goes back to them, and I said, oh, my offer expires at 5 o'clock today. So he goes back to them and comes back and goes, listen, they won't take 127. I'll take 127, 500. They'll give you the 60 days. They'll give you the 30. I said, we've done a deal. Deposit will be paid tonight. So that's what I did.
Wow.
To do the actual demo, what I did is I subdivided that property. So for those people who don't know, that's where I take a single house on a block of land. I can split it in two separate titles. I build a brand new one at the back, and I've still got the one at the front. So we done the demo. I had six mates out of the construction game come around. It cost me about six labs of beer and a barbecue to get it done. And I did a subdivide. But I've probably been a bit long-winded here, Jake, but at the end of the day, this was my first deal. So I got a town planner. He did the planning permits for me. He knew somebody in council. Got a builder to come in. They give me the build price. So we did the demo on the front one. We subdivided. We built the extra property at the back. So that property, in a period of around about 2 to 2.5 years, went from 127,000 to 290.
Nice.
Right. And the rental return was through the roof because I'm getting what's called positive cash flow. So the property was paying for itself. The tenants were paying for it. But then I started to learn about tax depreciation, the difference between buying an established property and buying a new property. So because I built the new one, I was getting massive tax deductions against my income. So I'm paying less tax. Then you can use that money to leverage off and start paying your house down. This is how it all started to unravel as I started to learn this stuff, right? I could have made another 30-odd thousand on that particular deal if I did a couple of things a different way. But, Jake, I didn't know at the time. But now that I know a little bit more, these, you know, a couple of little mistakes that I made that cost a bit more. But that was the second deal that I did. And it was really just from reading a few books and understanding how to negotiate and how to find out what a vendor wants and just looking for an angle.
I would always look for, like, what is your edge? So what do you know that someone else doesn't know? Mm. And, like, a simple truth is that information travels unfairly. So there's not everyone in the marketplace knows the same stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you can be confident that you know something that someone else doesn't know, then that's where you have the ability to make a margin, to create returns. Mm-hmm. And what I love about that story is the way that you pull together all these different resources for the first time and just did it. Like, how cool. A lot of people just sit on the sofa all day long and do absolutely nothing. And that's, like, you know, primary hustle. Like, your mates off the construction site, they'll knock it down in half a day, done. I particularly like that idea of buddying up with an agent that can give you the inside scoop on a distressed seller. And I mean, just personally speaking, at the moment, I've been looking at real estate deals in and around Byron Bay for a year or so. Mm-hmm. And the prices that are being asked are absolutely out of control. They're all talking it up so much that it's just, you know, it's not worth my time, essentially. That's a story for another day. But that's a really important piece of the puzzle, is a friendly agent that was able to give you deal flow, essentially. It's like, look, there's 400 properties for sale in Geelong. I just want the one that's distressed. Tell me which one that is. Boom, there you have your answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, Tony, that there was probably another 30 or so grand that you might have been able to make from that deal that you didn't. Why was it that you didn't make that money?
There were some things that I could have did with the town planner, which I didn't, which give us time delays, which cost more money. There were some things that I didn't have inclusives of in the build contract that I was unaware of, right, because I didn't get the contract checked out correctly. I should have had a legal conveyance to go over it. There was a few little terms and conditions where, you know, I got what they call variations to the build contract, right, which technically they could do because it was in black and white, but I missed a few of those things. So combined all up, probably would have made about another 30,000 on that deal. And remember, we're talking 23 years ago, right?
Yeah, it's a long time ago. Yeah,
that's a long time ago now. You know, those properties have all tripled since then. But My biggest thing when it comes to property and real estate, for any of the listeners that are keen on property or investing in property, you have to build a good team around you, right? You need a smart finance broker. You need a smart legal conveyancer. You need a smart tax accountant. You need a smart property advisor. You need a good property manager, right? But you want to build a team of people who are, and my team that I've got now and that I've built over the years are all property investors. They're specialists in their own niche area, you know, tax accountant, finance broker, et cetera, but they're all investors. They're all property investors. We all do what we talk. So walking your talk, having people on your team that are already out there doing it and get it. You know, like structuring loans is very important. People are out there today in today's environment, stressed off their heads with the cost of living, inflation, all that stuff, trying to pay off a house, right? Even though interest rates have just come down once or twice, they're stressing because power bills are going up, petrol bills going up, gas is going up, your food's going up, your kids' schooling's going up, right? But when you structure yourself financially from an investment point of view, there's a big difference between investment debt and mortgage debt. Big difference. And if you can leverage off investment debt and then reduce your taxes and get your taxes coming back over to start knocking off that mortgage and paying an extra $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000 a year off your mortgage, you're going to fast track paying off that. But the big advantage is you've got two investments going up in once, your home and your property. But most people, if we just backtrack to what you said earlier, Jake, most people let fear stand in the way. They want to do it. And I've been running my business now for 14 years now. People want to do it. They want to invest. They want to take a step. They probably want to buy Bitcoin. They want to buy this. They want to get into property. They want to do stuff. And the one thing that I think always holds them back is a lack of knowledge. And with a lack of knowledge, then that brings up the fear. Because then they say, oh, what if I lose money? What if I make a mistake? What if I do it wrong? Oh, I can't afford it. I don't know. It's more debt. You know what I mean? They've got all this stuff that they bring up and they just let it hold them back. And the other big fallacy out there is, oh, gee, I've got to pay off my house before I invest. Well, you wait 30 years till you pay off your house and you're going to be paying triple for your first investment property. Whereas if you buy it as soon as you can leverage, you know, what was the old saying? What was the best time to buy real estate? Yesterday in Australia, right? So people's fears, that's why I do a lot of work on mindset, right? I'm really focused on attracting clients who are got the right mindset around it. They're keen. They want to invest. They want to do well in life. They want to look after their family, their kids. And they have to overcome those fears because, and the way to do that is get the knowledge. You know, I remember a few years back, I looked at Bitcoin. If we were, you know, swing topics for a second, I looked at Bill. I don't know about this. Who pays me? I don't know. And for years, I had this thing about, mate, oh, what am I, who am I giving money to? Where's it going? Like, I don't know, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't do it. And I've been in a mastermind group now for the last 3 years. And some of those guys that I'm with now are at the top of the tree at this caper. They've been in this crypto field for, you know, 20 plus years. The AI field they've been in for 24, 25 years. Now that I've spent a couple of years inside the mastermind group and I'm learning, I'm understanding, I'm talking to people who know what they're doing, I'm in it now and I'm playing the game as well. So I'm diversified across into that space as well. But I've got to say, what if I had did that 5 years ago, Jake?
Well, yeah, that's, you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda.
Exactly. Property's the same, right?
It's hard.
Yeah. Property's the same.
We'll definitely get to the Bitcoin piece because I have a number of things I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
Straight on that point about the mastermind, that's the relationship building skill that you've already touched on. Like, go out there, find some people that know what they're talking about, get access to them and just sit there and just soak it all up. And that's how you learn. So, like, you know, hats off to that. Because I think, you know, a lot of people don't even take that step, right?
Yeah. People are busy. They've got to watch Home and Away. They've got to watch Neighbours. They've got to watch Netflix. Like, they're busy, man. They're flat out. Like, hey, I haven't got time for this shit, mate. It's like, I gave away weekends. I gave away nights. I stopped watching TV. I started reading books. I started going to seminars. I started doing courses and workshops and reading books and stuff. And you've got to put in the work.
People aren't willing to do the work. They're just not. They're not willing to. And that's okay. you crack on and do whatever you want. But there's another option. And that's really what we're talking through today. I'm intrigued to just continue on this real estate journey because it's infinitely fascinating to me because, you know, shelter is a primary need. Like it's very simple. You need a house to live in. And I'm someone that's gone as long Bitcoin as possible and I rent. And I've had a number of headaches from that decision, not necessarily from a financial returns perspective, but from a physical process of like, I need somewhere to live.
Yeah.
And what's tricky is this difference between real estate as shelter and real estate as a financialized investment product. And they're kind of two different things. And I feel like they've decoupled pretty massively from, you know, providing utility value to actually creating a kind of productized or financialized market for people to bet on. And we'll talk about store value later. But Australia is an interesting country in terms of its real estate market because of the different levers that are being able to be pulled. So although it's a small country by population of 25 million or so, to my understanding, the percentage of migrants is as high in terms of population growth as some of the fastest population growth in the world in sub-Saharan Africa as a comparison. So the amount of people that are migrating to the country is increasing the population at the same rate as places that, you know, grab the headlines for going crazy in terms of population growth. So people are arriving very fast, and with that they need hospitals, roads, farms, markets, schools and houses. So, you know, if you think back to those prices you were paying in 2002, 2005, they may have tripled by this stage. What is the main driver in that increase in price?
Your key drivers for property and real estate, especially in Australia, right? The Australian culture is brought up, the mantra is go to school, get a job, get an education, work hard and buy yourself a house. That's what 99% of the population are taught, right? And that's where most people go. So people love real estate, they love bricks and mortar, but I mean, you hit on some good points there a minute ago. Here we are in 2025. The Australian government post-COVID have brought in about 1.8 million people into this country. And that in the last 2 years. Since 2023. And in the last 2 years, they've brought in.
Yeah,
they've
brought in 800,000 a year.
Oh, easily. Oh. It was 1.2 million there at one point came in. But here's the thing. When you talk property, right, you're talking a really big macro market, right, because there's a lot of factors that affect real estate. So there could be things like employment. There could be bank financing and lending. How tight are the banks? Are they lending money out? Are they tight? Are interest rates high? Is unemployment high? Have people got jobs? Is there infrastructure? Is there business investment? Is there population coming into these areas? There's a whole mixture of stuff. It's always a moving game. There's one area or demographic. The government can bring in some rule changes like they did in Victoria. They introduced the COVID land tax. 30,000 investors sold properties down there and said, see you later, we're out. In Australia today, we've got a major rental crisis. We've got a rental shortage. There's not enough properties out there for people to live in. We've got a trades shortage. They can't get enough tradesmen to build these projects. There's billions of dollars of infrastructure going on around this country. So all the tradies are going to the big infrastructure projects because they're going to make three, four, five times the money they're going to make being out in the housing market building houses, right? So builders can't get tradies. Materials have gone up 30, 40%. So our cost to build have gone up. Big developers are shelving major apartment projects and big projects because they know they can't build them at the price that they done the feasibilities on 3, 4, 5 years ago when they were planning these projects. So a lot of projects are getting shelved. You add all those dynamics up and then introduce immigration. All these people have to live somewhere, right? And for me, I sit here as a property investor and I don't like to see people going through hard times or tough times. I look at it from an investor's mindset and go, holy shit, this is an opportunity because these people need somewhere to live. So rents have gone up 20, 30, 40% in the last couple of years, right? So people understand the supply and demand. And I don't see this getting any better. The government's around there spruiking how they're going to build 1.2 million houses. Well, they haven't even built 200 in the last 2 years. So I don't know how they're going to build 1.2 in the next five. And with all these dynamics going on, I just see property as a vehicle where they've now brought in the other thing affecting real estate in Australia right now. They've also brought in all these first homeowner grants, 5% deposits, bank guarantees, government guarantees. I don't agree with any of it, because any time I've seen government involved in sort of property schemes, they always turn to shit, generally speaking. So you've got all these dynamics in play, and as an investor, I'm just sitting here going, I don't care what anybody says, because I know the properties are going to keep going up. I know rents are going to keep going up. You've got the Greens that were wanting to stop people from putting up their rent and stop free enterprise. Well, those loonies have been voted out, thank God. And so there's all these factors at play that really, if someone's sitting there today and they want to build their wealth, they've got a home, they've got equity, they've probably got some cash as well in reserve, they've got a good job, they're earning good income. If they set it up and structure it, they could be buying investment properties, providing housing for people in the rental market that need it, getting a good rental return, interest rates are pretty good, properties are pretty much going to pay for themselves. They could actually start reducing their tax, start paying off their houses faster, have two properties going up in value, and they can be much better off. Because the reason why I really dived into property back in the day, Jake, was that I understand people are going to live on their superannuation, but again, around about 91% of this population are not going to have enough superannuation to live on when they retire. There's a high percentage of people going to run out of money 5 to 7 years after they retire, because here's what they don't understand about super. Number one, you can't control the stock market. You can't control economies. You can't control the companies in the stock market. And you can't control world events. Have a look what happened recently when Trump introduced the trade tariffs. The market dropped 20-30%. You had, you know, the GFC, it dropped 30-40%. You had, you know, the buildings getting hit in 2001, dropped 40% overnight. I mean, there's no control as an individual. You can't control your money that's in a superannuation fund because it's predominantly in the stock market, right? But I can control real estate. And I can build real estate, and I can add value to real estate, and I can subdivide, and I can renovate. There's a whole range of things I can do. And, you know, the majority of people are going to get caught out with just paying off their house and having some super. They're going to be around, you know, 500,000 plus short of what they need to live on, because the thing they miss is this. They sit there today and go, oh, look, I'm nearly 50. I'm going to retire in 15 years, and my super statement says I'll probably have $600,000 to live on, right? What they're not doing is thinking about, hang on a minute, 15 years from today in Australia, on average, CPI and inflation doubles every 14 to 15 years. So if you want to live on $1,000 a week in today's money, 15 years from today, you're going to need $2,000. So your $600,000 that you projected to have for your retirement is going to be worth $300,000, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to live on $2,000 a week, you're out of money in about 5 years. And if there's a stock market crash or something crazy happens at the time and that's all you've got all your eggs in one basket, you're a sitting duck and you're going to get screwed. And I've been telling people this for 20 odd years.
Yeah, it's scary, isn't it? This is a great topic in that people don't ask, what's my purchasing power? And the system that we were born into it's clever in that the metric we measure value in, i.e. dollars or pounds or euros, it's actually disintegrating in value. So when something looks like it's going up in value, i.e. the price is going up, it's actually that denominator is decreasing in value because they're putting more dollars into the system, more euros into the system. And when you look at your retirement pension pot, so a superannuation for anyone that's not in Australia is a pension. It's for your retirement. You're absolutely right. They're not going, okay, what's my purchasing power today? Well, what do I need it to be in 15 years' time? Okay, well, let's figure out that $600,000 today is actually the equivalent of the median house in Sydney. Great. In 15 years' time, $600,000 is not going to be the median price of a house in Sydney. And that's just the housing market as a metric. Like, what's the gold price going to do in comparison in 15 years' time? What's the Bitcoin price going to do in 15 years' time? And so as investors, that's essentially what we're doing every day, which is, what is the opportunity cost of not owning different stuff? And in your case, you've been on a wonderful ride in the real estate market. And let's go into the kind of crypto conversation now. It's interesting to me that you're looking at that because, to be frank about how I look at real estate now, I look at real estate as a highly inflated market that requires you to run a small business. So if you're a property investor, if you're actually going to take on the title of a property, you need to have an accountant, you need to have a finance broker, you need to have a property manager. Try and do it all yourself and you'll be completely overblown by how much is actually going on and get stressed by the whole thing. And so as long as you're aware of the fact that being a property investor requires you to run a small property business, then that's okay. But when I stumbled across Bitcoin and I'm like, hang on, this thing's just a savings technology. I don't have to do anything. It just sits in a digital wallet that I can control, that no one can take from me. I don't have a tenant calling me up saying the shower's broken, or a neighbor being, you know, your tenant's playing music too loud, or an agent that's like, actually, we've just sacked our really good operations manager. You don't have any of those headaches. It just sits there, and the purchasing power has been flying in terms of capital growth. So as of right now, I don't own any physical real estate, and I did 5 years ago. And in terms of like a portfolio allocation out loud, if I'm thinking today, I'm about 80% Bitcoin, and it was probably 80% real estate 4 or 5 years ago. So I'm intrigued, Tony, like if you were to talk me through and reveal as much or as little as you want, but in terms of like when you think about everything you own, like how much of it is real estate and how much of it has become crypto? And even you sent me recently a report that you'd received from your mastermind about some alternative tokens you're looking at. And we'll talk about crypto versus Bitcoin as well. But I'm just intrigued, how is your thought process thinking? And are you doing different stuff with your money than you were before?
Yeah, look, it's a really good point. It's an interesting time because I'm really interested in what's happening in the US with Trump. You know, digital currency over there, they're talking about buying 200, you know, million worth of Bitcoin and all the things that they're doing. Big people like BlackRock and those sorts of dudes are getting into the crypto space. And like it's the AI that's coming out. We're heading into a whole new world. I think the whole financial system is going to get rewritten in the next 18 months to 2 years. The traditional banking system that we're looking at, right? For me, I'm about a 70-30, right? 70% real estate, and I've got 30% in various other things. So as in crypto, coins, I've got gold, silver. I've got venture capital money that I've put in, which is a little bit more speculative, but it's money that I know that if I lose it tomorrow, I'm not going to, you know, be out on the street looking for somewhere to sleep. So I've got a nice little spread going around, self-managed super fund, a few other different things, right? But I'm really interested to see what happens with what's going to be called tokenization, where you're going to be able to tokenize your real estate, for instance. And you can start trading tokens. And now, again, Jake, I'm not 100% up to speed with all this. I'm sort of watching it and learning it as I go. But I'm really interested to see what happens in the real estate space in regard to, you know, coins and tokens and tokenization and stuff like that. I don't know if you've got any heads up on it, but I'm really keeping an eye on it because is it another way to maneuver, you know? And then, and again, I'm still not 100% into that side of my world, but I am learning as I go, you know, how to have your wallet set up and how do I trade currencies? Like if you and I were to trade some money and like, how does all that work? How do I get my money out of the banking system into this game? That's all still a bit foreign to me, but I am learning and I am doing it on a bit of a step-by-step basis, pretty similar to what I did with the property actually back in the day. But yeah, that's probably where I'm sitting at the moment.
Cool. And it makes a lot of sense to be like, you know, 70, 75% real estate because that's your thing. Mm. You know, that's what you spent 20, 30 years doing. Like you say, you can't control what the NASDAQ's going to do.
No.
But you can run a really solid portfolio of rental properties with whatever cash flow you want to create from them. You can finance them how you want. And to some degree, you do have more control of that for sure. Mm. I'm yet to see an actually valuable use case for tokenization. And I'm very, very dubious of the underlying motivation of some of the projects that are promoting that stuff. And the you mentioned venture, like I'm really interested in venture investing and I tend to focus on, I'm just about to make my first kind of early stage equity investment in over 5 years in a company called Setlantis, which is a business in the travel space. And they're using Bitcoin and this thing called Nostr that I'm really keen on, which is a an uncensorable communications protocol. So it's a combination of Bitcoin, AI, and Nostr. But to buy equity in that business, you know, you've got a due diligence process, you've got a shareholder agreement, you've got additional investors that were already in the first round that are very, very high caliber VC funds. So you know that they're not putting money into something that's fake. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the crypto tokens, there's some people out there that are very, very good at marketing the future, but actually they're just pocketing your cash. And so I would look at basically all altcoin purchase as highly speculative software ventures. And so in the same bracket as a VC risk, it's like it could all just disappear tomorrow, but you also might see one do 1,000%. And so that's at least how I would look at that. And of course, from the perspective you just shared, it's like actually you're sitting in your real estate, that's your bedrock, that's your HQ. That's like, cool, from here I can actually make some more high risk bets. And that definitely makes sense. Does any of that resonate, Tony, at all from what I just spoke through?
Yeah, look, it does, Jake. And I think, you know, it's going to be an interesting 5 or so years ahead of us because there's so much that's going to play out, but there's so much that a lot of us don't understand either. And we don't understand the terminology of a lot of this stuff. And we don't and a lot of it's, you know, talking in abbreviated language and we don't even know or get it right. So people are out there taking a punt. I know the tradies on the building sites, they just throw their money into the next thing that someone tells them to do because they've just got no idea. Oh, yeah, you can make a heap of money out of this, or I made a heap of money out of that. It's just like punting and gambling. Whereas I like to be a bit more, I would say not sophisticated, but I like to understand. I don't want to put money into something that I don't know or don't understand, right? Because my gut instinct says to me, you don't know yet. You need to know. And for me, to take a couple of those more sort of, you know, the venture capital stuff, which are riskier investments, but I'm not betting the house on them. I've got buffers behind me as well, which if I lose a bit here or lost a bit over here, I'm not going to go down the chute because I know that I've got plenty others sitting around, right? So I think that people, generally speaking, mum and dad, so let's talk about, say, mum and dad, out there trying to get ahead in life and hope they're going to have a good time when they retire, they need to get involved in some stuff and they need to learn some stuff, whether it's property, whether it's Bitcoin, you know, whatever it may be, whatever form, but they need to be doing something outside the norm of what the government are telling you to do, because having a house and having a super is not going to be the answer to a happy life. But the key, you know, this sort of goes back to what we spoke about earlier, people just don't have the knowledge. People just aren't getting taught, they're not learning it, and therefore they're going to sit and they'll stay stuck and they're not going to end up in a real good place. And you know, in a country like Australia with the wealth and the opportunity we've got in this country, it's absolutely crazy that people end up like that.
But that's kind of where, and again, to touch on that word spirituality, this whole, I've had some other conversations already on this podcast since launching in January, which like they get really spiritual and it's quite intense in terms of how you start to, you can literally like change your vibration, and as your frequency alters, different people come into your life. And so that person that you've just described who's like, I'm gonna just pay down my mortgage, rely on the super, that's a low vibration in my mind. They're not someone who's thinking that they have to take any risk or can't take any risk. They're full of fear, and they ultimately, they just blame everyone else for all their problems. Whereas there are other people out there that are like, all right, fuck this. Let's figure this out. And that's a higher vibration. And I get drawn to that quite easily. And I have to be really careful now, starting to notice it's like, actually, that's dragging me down. And I still haven't quite figured out how to manage extricating myself from those situations because I'm like a bit too polite or whatever. I'm like, how do I get out of that? But one thing I'm intrigued about, Tony, we've got 10 minutes or so left, is my biggest loss as an investor is in physical real estate. And I got hammered by a couple of different things that all converged together. And I ended up in this crazy situation. It's like, this is 2021. It's like, okay, the property that you thought was valued at X is actually 50% less than that. And I exited the position in favor of buying Bitcoin. And that Bitcoin is now 5 times more valuable. So the risk I took was worth it. But I guess I'm a bit scarred from that real estate experience. And what I'd love to know is, like, that I think is my biggest loss and my biggest lesson. And it drove me into the hands of Bitcoin in some way. It's like, you don't have anyone complaining about the shower. You don't have a tenant who disappears. You don't have a mortgage to pay every month. It just sits there and does nothing. I'm like, yes, please. What, if you think back over the last 20 years or so, like, what were some of your best deals that you remember? And what were some of your absolute horror shows? And yeah, I feel well, like that... the franchise is going to be hard to beat.
True. No, listen, I've had property deals go down too as well. Don't worry about that. And again, you know, it goes back to not following instinct as well. I mean, I bought a property. I got involved with a couple of guys a few years ago. I've always been residential. That was my bread and butter. That's what I learned. That's what I knew. That's what I'm good at doing. That's what I still do today. But I sidetracked a bit, got involved in a commercial deal where we bought this plot of dirt, 4,000 square meters. We were going to build a childcare center. We went to council. We followed all the regs. You know, we put the applications in. Everything was looking honky-dory. But unbeknownst to us, the guy that lived next door to the vacant block that we bought, turns out he was a solicitor. And for those that don't know, Geelong's like a big country town, and he's pally with people on the council who had to approve our development. We got knocked back. Long story short, right, we're stuck with this plot of dirt, couldn't build anything on it. And we'd spent, you know, a couple hundred thousand bucks on the application. We went to VCAT where it was challenged. We had lawyers, we had traffic experts, we had noise experts, on and on and on it went. The guy I got caught up with never had the money that he said he had, right? So I dropped about 160 grand, right? But I had to sell off a couple of properties, pay out what I had to pay out. Massive lesson though, Jake. I mean, I'm a big believer
Were you taking leverage to buy that piece of dirt, or was it just a cash deal to purchase in the first place?
We were going to leverage the build because the build was quite substantial, but the money went in on the land. We were all in on that. Right. So we're stuck with this plot of dirt.
Yeah.
Now,
well, because but I also see now people are pushing to people finance the purchase of the dirt. So before you build anything, you've already got a debt burden and you don't know how long it's going to take to go through the planning process. And it's like that. Well, it would just be very stressful if you don't have the ability to carry the debt or you're not as strong at carrying the debt as you thought you were. Oh, that sounds like a horror show. So in some ways, that's a good idea for people out there just to recognize how it's a very human market, real estate. Because at some point, the solicitor buddy was like, mate, just don't let them build anything next to my house. And his mate was doing it. And it's just, what are you going to do?
We should have just went and knocked on his door, on the next door neighbors. Hey, look, we're looking at buying this land. We're thinking about a childcare center. Yep. And we probably would have met him. And, you know, we might have got the vibe. That's a mistake, right? Rookie mistake.
Yeah.
People think, here's the problem with real estate, Jake. I feel that people just see blue sky. Oh, you know, buy real estate and you can make money. Buy real estate, subdivide, you can make money. Well, I'll tell you what, you can buy real estate, subdivide, get a shit builder, have a bit of rock in the ground that you weren't expecting. You know, unexpected costs with councils, with power, with gas. Like, I mean, there's a ton of stuff. Mm. There is no such thing as just a real cruisy, easy ride with real estate and making money. It just does not happen.
Yeah,
and if you don't have
kind of rent vesting or passive income that they push, yeah.
Yeah, oh, look, all these idiots get it, oh, you know, buy 10 properties in 10 years and all this bullshit. It is just complete BS. I'll give you the basis of what I teach my clients. It's really simple, Jake.
Yeah, please. Let's spend another 5 minutes or so. So if someone was thinking about getting in touch with you, Tony, like, what is the service you guys offer?
Well, the first thing we want to do is have a sit down and have a chat over the phone or a one-on-one and go, well, look, where are you at and what are you trying to do and what are you trying to achieve, right? So people need to take stock of their current financial position. And a lot of people, Jake, won't do that because they don't want to face it. So that's number one.
Okay. They're not even sure as to like what they own and how much.
Most people don't even know where their money goes every week. They just know it goes, it's gone, but oh, I don't know where to go, what do I spend it on, right? So they don't have their cash flow under control. They don't have a goal or a game plan. What are they actually trying to do? What are they trying to achieve? How much money do they need to accumulate to give them whatever life it is they want when they retire, or when do they want to retire early? Everyone's different. But I can tell you, because I've surveyed the construction industry over the years and I've physically gone out and surveyed people who are earning good money, and over 90% of them don't have any sort of plan, don't have any sort of strategy. They don't have a goal.
Wow.
They don't even know how much they need to retire. And I don't know, I probably need $1 million. They haven't got a clue, right? So until you know that, once you know that, then you've got a target. So then you can say, well, what's the game plan? What's the strategy? How do we set this up? How do we structure it? But I just take people on this step-by-step journey and say, well, look, let's assess your position now. Let's get your cash flow under control. Let's get your loans and everything structured correctly, because that is super important when you're going to invest. Then when it comes to being in a position to buy real estate, my job as a property investment advisor is I go into the market, I do the research, I do the demographic data, I show people where to buy, what to buy, and I package the whole deal up on behalf of the client. So the client doesn't have to go, oh, shit, where will I buy? What will I do? Well, who do I talk to? Because that freaks people out. And there's a lot of dodgies in the building industry. There's a lot of shady characters out there. So I've built relationships over 15 years with some really good project builders and people that I've got a network and connection to. But I'm looking for areas where high capital growth's coming in, where population's growth coming in, where shopping centres, schools, hospitals. I mean, I park three or four clients next to a $950 million hospital and people in the suburb didn't even know it was getting built.
Wow.
And there's 1.3 billion to come in behind us on the shopping centre, right? Train station's just gone in. These are the things that give you the uplift. And for most mum and dads, here's all they need to do. If it comes to property and real estate, have your home and get it paid off as fast as you can if that's where you're at. Have your superannuation because your employers or whoever are probably tipping in the money for you for that, which is fine. But by gee, get one or two investments over here. And I just talk one or two properties to most of my clients. Hold them for 15 to 20 years. Get your cash flow under control. Have your house paid off. Then there's a strategy of how to pay the investment debt off. Structure it correctly. And it doesn't have to be property either, Jake. I believe that if they're paying off a house, they've got some super, they've got to be doing something else, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's starting a part-time business, whether it's property, whatever. Be doing something else, because if you're sitting there with just your home and your super, you're nothing but a sitting duck.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it? I was watching some good content today. There's an excellent investment analyst called Lynn Alden. Have you ever come across Lynn before?
I haven't, no.
I'll send it to you. But she has a presentation called Nothing Stops This Train. And it was recently a very popular post from a Bitcoin conference in the States. And she just runs through the numbers as to how broke the US Federal Reserve and government actually are.
There
is no doubt in my mind that the amount of money that's going to be printed in the next 5 to 10 years by every single central bank, it's going to be mind-blowing. You know, we think about $1 trillion. Like, how much is $1 trillion? It's inconceivable an amount of money. And they're going to be printing trillions and trillions and trillions of this stuff. You know, Bank of Australia is definitely going to be doing the same thing. And if you don't own hard assets that will match the inflation rate, you're completely screwed. And you're literally getting poorer every single day. Well, I think that's a bit of a depressing place to leave it. But there are things you can do. I think that's what's so cool, Tony. When I speak to someone like yourself that's got so much more life experience than me, there are ups and there are downs. But the mindset is the key throughout that to kind of grow through it, isn't it? And that's really what that's what's resonating for me today. It's like, shit, that would have been hard. But okay, this is how you might kind of think that through. Tony, thank you so much for your time tonight. I've really enjoyed that. The last question I have for you is, if people do want to reach out, how do they do that? What's the best way to contact you?
Yeah, look, people can just go onto my website, tonyharringtonco.com.au, and have a look, check me out. I work boutique. I don't work with every Tom, Dick and Harry that comes along. I'm very boutique who I work with. But if you want to have a chat with me, book a call with me, or have a look at your situation, see where we go. It could be a good thing for us to do. If not, we just shake hands and say goodbye. So there's no pressure. I don't run around with a suit and tie on, Jake, and a briefcase full of property contracts. That's not how I operate. All the shonkies out there, that's what they do, but I don't. But yeah, mate, look, if people just want an assessment or a review of where they're at, if we can help them do a bit better. I've got money coaching programs and personal development. There's stuff I can do to help people. I've got property investment coaching programs that I do as well to educate, because I'm thinking about, let's educate people around money, finances, personal development, mindset. Because, you know, really all I want to do is see people live a better life. And unfortunately, in our country, financial stress is huge. It affects people's mental health and well-being. that affects their relationships, their marriages break down, families get broken up. And I've seen a lot of suicide, especially in the construction industry that I came out of. And this, wow, a lot of this really relates back to money. And for me, I'm not about making millions and millions myself. I'm about being in a position financially to live my life my way every day, the way I choose. And I've been living this way now for 15 or so years. Get out of bed when I want to get out of bed, go to the beach, go and train at the gym, do the things I want to do. That to me is wealth. And it's not about a specific number. It's about, can you get yourself to that position where you're living the life that you want to live and you've got the money to do that? And that's really, I think, more important. Your happiness and your health and your well-being supersedes any of that, but you need money to do it.
Oh, awesome. And amen to that. That's a far more positive way to do it.
Yeah.
Talk about the doomsday of inflation. Well, thank you, mate, so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Jake. It's been great to be on, and I hope the listeners got a lot of value out of it. And thanks so much for the opportunity. Much appreciated.